guest speaker this morning before we go into a question and answer session is Bill Schneider Jr., who is now at the Hudson Institute. He's a staff associate on the Subcommittee on Defense of the House of Representatives Appropriation Committee. He is a member of President-elect Reagan's Defense Transition Team. He is also an economist, having received his PhD from New York University. He has written on problems of strategic nuclear warfare, land and tactical air warfare, and unconventional warfare. He is the co-author of the annual survey of the Department of Defense budget issues. And of course, many of you know him as formerly with Senator James Buckley's staff and with the Senator's office. He's a longstanding member of the Philadelphia Society, and he has spoken here on several occasions before. His topic today is military balance. What are the consequences of it, and what should we do about it? Bill?
Hearing Professor Rood's description of the difficulties of getting supplies through the Malta and the last war seemed to be roughly parallel to the difficulties in getting a piece of mail from North Adams, Michigan to New York. It's not very good in either case. I find that I'm at a somewhat disadvantageous point on this program, not only because I've been obliged to speak after a trio of unfairly talented gentlemen, but also I appear to be the last person standing between the audience and the bar, so I will try and be to the point. What I think is important to mention as far as public policy purposes are concerned about the strategic balance is just to take note of the consequences of a few of the developments that have occurred over the course of the past dozen or 15 years. And enumerate a few of the consequences that these have had, and then offer a few suggestions as to what might be done about it. We do have an important and perhaps historic opportunity to make a dramatic change in the course of events that has dominated the better part of the past two decades. First, with respect to the strategic balance, Helmut Sonnenfeld and some of the other commentators from the Nixon and Ford administration who have taken some note of Soviet behavior have observed that the only thing that Soviet culture has given the world is its military power. But this is no trifle, and I think we should pay attention to what its consequences are. Soviets, as Professor Pipes has noted, have taken particular care to feed and sustain their strategic nuclear power because they, I believe, properly recognize that strategic forces, while not sufficient for the extension of Soviet influence throughout the world, are undeniably a necessary component of it. And the growth of Soviet nuclear power, and this has been particularly true in the decade which we have just left, has appeared to be a very purposeful one that has developed a set of imbalances between American and Soviet military power that have genuine political and diplomatic consequences. By way of describing it briefly, the Soviets have deployed a set of strategic forces that have properties that make it possible for them to threaten our strategic posture, while our response has been insufficient to threaten Soviet strategic power. The obvious points have been the deployment, not only in terms of numbers, but in terms of the qualities of the forces, that is, the explosive yield of the warhead and the accuracy with which they can be delivered, has made it possible for the Soviets to threaten the entire range of U.S. strategic forces. Vulnerability of the land-based ICBM force is already well known, but the vulnerability of the bomber force is perhaps less well understood, but you should note that 25% or less of the bomber force is likely to escape destruction in the Soviet first strike because the balance of the force requires many hours to get off the ground. And those forces that do manage to get off the ground have to run a gauntlet of defenses that are at least as impressive as the German submarine force that caused such vast losses in Allied shipping during the last war. Similarly, the submarine force it has undergone some transformation that has not been too widely noted. The United States is building a new submarine called the Trident class of submarines. This is to replace an older class of submarines, the Polaris class. It turned out that the welding and the installation of pumps in the Trident submarines that are being built has been so dramatically poorly done, perhaps reflecting Mr. Harrigan's comments on the industrial base, that a 3 to 4 year delay has now been proposed in the Trident program before we will be able to get the other ships that are now under construction into the fleet. However, three of the 10 Polaris submarines have been cut up. Three more of them will run out of fuel and would have to face a one-year layup or more for refueling. So the even the submarine force, although it has been touted as being highly invulnerable, has been subject to just natural attrition owing to the difficulties associated with modernization, and not to mention the potential growth of anti-submarine forces. Similarly, in theater forces, that is, forces that are associated with conflict at less than the central strike between the two powers on their own land masses, have undergone a transformation that is perhaps less dramatic than the strategic nuclear environment, is at least as important, as I'll describe in a moment. The United States has 16 divisions in its army, about 750,000 men under arms. The Soviets have 170 divisions in their army, and they have well over 2 million men in their armed forces. It's rather 2 million men in their land forces. They have 4.8 million men in their armed forces in total. And that number has increased about 800,000 since 1970. That is, the growth in the Soviet armed forces since 1970 has exceeded the entire size of the U.S. forces now deployed. The United States in the past has taken some comfort, and perhaps rightly so, from the fact that not only were its forces more sustainable because it had a bigger logistics base, but they were more technically sophisticated than their adversary, and hence were more than a match for the more numerous Soviet forces. But this has ceased to be the case, and in fact, now the circumstance has arisen where the combat power in an individual Soviet division now exceeds the combat power in an American division. They have 18 maneuver battalions in their divisions. We have 12, and if modernization that has been restructuring that has been proposed succeeds, our total will go to about 15. But because the Soviets operate under a different doctrine of warfare than we do, that is, they emphasize the value of shock and mass and in a relatively brief but appallingly intense strike, that the Soviet concept of warfare may be somewhat better suited to the kind of environment that we're going to be in than the American concept, which emphasizes a protracted war with attrition. Without going into numerical detail about these, the consequences of this have been adverse for our diplomacy, because we have been left with, on the strategic side, a doctrine that is not in our interest to execute, namely the response to a Soviet first strike. It would be an American response on Soviet cities and Soviet urban industrial areas that would invite a Soviet attack in response on our own cities. The fact that it is not in our interest to execute such a strike has reduced the credibility of our strategic posture to zero, or at least not far from zero, and as a result has shifted the emphasis into an arena where the United States is at a technical and perhaps geopolitical disadvantage, namely in contesting for influence and power in relatively remote areas of the world. These require a fairly large standing army and a kind of diplomatic expertise in combination with military power that the United States has historically not shown much interest in doing. The result is that during the period of the 1980s, we are likely to face kind of dangers that we have not faced historically of a very well-prepared adversary who's in most aggregate measures of military power exceed our own, who is possessed of an ideology that enables him to threaten our vital interests without us having a symmetric ability to affect the adversaries. So this very difficult set of circumstances raises obvious questions about what can be done about it. And as I think we all know, most of a good part of the election that we've just emerged from addressed, however imperfectly, some of these issues. And I'll just mention a few points that I think are pertinent to addressing this problem, although it's going to the addressing these things in principle is a lot different from actually getting them done. First, I think the most important thing that is doable with given the political will and appropriate congressional and public support is the modernization of our military posture, and the most important dimension of that is our strategic nuclear forces. In the long run, we have a strategy that, as I said, is not in our interest to execute. We need to make some fundamental changes. No strategy is going to be viable in the long term, I would argue, without some viable theory of homeland defense. We, in 1972, signed a treaty to limit anti-ballistic missile defenses, and that was done in the expectation that severe limits could be subsequently imposed by treaty on offensive forces. That has that expectation has proved to be false, and as a consequence, we are, I think, should feel obliged to review that possibility. We do have an opportunity in the 1982 review conference on the ABM treaty to take a hard look at that, and I'm hopeful that the new administration is prepared to do that. Second point is the question of the ability of our military establishment to project its power abroad. One of the most fundamental changes the Carter administration made in American defense policy was by way of restricting the scope or its definition of the scope of American interests abroad. It was able to offer the Congress a basis for or a rationale for reduction in our projection forces. The most important, though not the only part of our projection forces, is the Navy, and this has suffered most most seriously. This can be sort of summarized by a single number. The Ford administration in its last budget proposed a five-year shipbuilding program of 157 ships, a number of which were major combatants. The Carter administration has had 4 or 5 year defense plans in each one of its defense programs. They've been as low as a 63 ship shipbuilding program, and although the most recent version is up to 83 ships, it still nevertheless reflects a massive reduction in the modernization of U.S. naval power. And it's so massive is the reduction proposed by the previous administration that by 1990 there would be only about 250 ships in the Navy if ships were retired as they wear out. The ability to project power is I think going to be especially crucial owing to the head start that the Soviets have in such areas as Southern Africa, the Horn of Africa, and Southwest Asia. Third point of emphasis is to emphasize ways of increasing the combat power of U.S. forces. The U.S. forces, as I noted earlier, have been designed to support a World War II type of mobilization and to emphasize the attrition of adversary forces rather than maneuver and paralysis of the enemy's command and control mechanism, which is the latter being the Soviet course. the need to get more combat power in our armed forces is something of a technical matter, but it is also a political matter as well, in that the need to have highly agile and effective combat forces in being is has been a contentious issue since the Vietnam War. I hope it will become less contentious in this administration so that it can get done. Three quick final points, and these are more overtly political. One is the role of the United States in our alliance structure. Under the previous administration in particular, the notion of consultation and consensus among the alliance has replaced the more traditional concept that we've had in especially the NATO alliance of American leadership. And as a consequence, just the dynamics of the consensus process have led to a drift and an interest on the part of the principal allies, especially Germany, in cutting separate deals with the Soviets outside the context of the alliance. A restoration of not only a policy but a mindset on the part of the American leadership to assert its dominance over the alliance in terms of setting the course for the alliance is something that I think will have a salutary effect on the unity of the West. And the final point is the question of arms control policy. Professor Pipes has ably pointed out the deficiencies of SALT II, and we, in principle, need to find a way in which arms control can be reformulated in a way that will tend to serve the interest of American security rather than drive it. All of these things are, each one in itself is could be a major accomplishment by any administration. The danger we face is that nearly all of them need to be effectively countered if we're going to change them. And at this point in the let's say the transition process, I only can hope that the President Reagan means what he said during the campaign. Thank you.
If President-elect Reagan doesn't mean what he said during the campaign, there are a lot of people around here that's going to remind him what he said during the campaign.